We don't know much about the childhood of Jesus, the experiences that formed and shaped him. The only record we have in the Gospels is the one depicted in our stained glass window of Luke's story of Jesus as a 12-year-old ditching Mary and Joseph and teaching in the temple in Jerusalem, and the scribes being amazed and astonished by his understanding. In Mark's Gospel, the Gospel we are spending most of this year with, there is no account of his early years. Jesus just pops up on the shores of the Jordan River with John the Baptist saying of him, "I am not worthy to stoop down and untie the thong of his sandals." Then the first six chapters of Mark's Gospel rapidly string together stories of Jesus' early ministry in breathless succession. First, he calls the 12 to him. Then he heals a man with an unclean spirit. Then he heals Simon's mother-in-law. Then he heals a leper. Then a paralytic. Then a man with a withered hand. Then he casts out a bunch of demons. Then he releases some truth bombs on the religious establishment. Then he teaches in parables the sower, the lamp under a bushel basket, the growing seed, a mustard seed. Then he takes a nap. Then he stills a storm at the sea. Then as the energy and crowd around him builds to a crescendo, he heals a hemorrhaging woman and raises a little girl from the dead. Jesus is on the top of his game, riding a wave of popularity. Everyone wants a piece of him, a real spiritual high flyer. And then he goes to Nazareth. Jesus goes to his hometown and tries to do what he has been doing, teaching and healing. He tries, but there in Nazareth, the spiritual high flyer lands with a thud. As he has done many other times in many other places, he goes to the synagogue to teach. But unlike other times and other places, he's not met there with respect, but doubt and anger. These are his neighbors, the people who watched him grow up in their midst. "Where did this man get these things? Who does this guy think he is?" they whisper to each other. "Isn't this Mary's kid?" And Mark says that they took offense at him, and he could do no acts of power there. So what is going on here? Why were his neighbors so hard on Jesus? Many scholars believe that the identification with Mary here is important, that it was an intentional insult, a put-down because of questions around Jesus' birth status. The people in Nazareth would have known or at least heard rumors that Joseph was not Jesus' biological father. In his book, Rabbi Jesus, in an intimate biography, Bruce Chilton argues that in his hometown, Jesus was seen as a mamzer, an Israelite of suspect paternity. Or to use a modern put-down, in Nazareth, Jesus was seen as a bastard. Chilton writes that this status shaped his life and his ministry. Such men and women lived in a caste, set apart, unable to marry within established bloodlines in Israel. So they were often excluded from the mainstream of Jewish life. From the beginning of his life, Jesus negotiated the treacherous terrain of between belonging to the people of God and ostracism in his own community. Jesus enfleshed divine power, the power to heal, to reconcile, and draw people to him. But this episode in Nazareth also shows his humanity, his vulnerability, his ability to feel the sting of rejection. Mark writes that he could do no deed of power there. The high flyer was grounded. His status as a mamzer and not being accepted by his neighbors wounded Jesus. It was a wound he carried his whole life and one that would shape his life and his ministry. There are times when the wounds we carry have nothing to do with anything that we've done or not done. Jesus did not create the societal norms around birth status, but he had to bear the weight of them. There are other times when we bear the wounds of things we have done, actions we have taken or not taken. In the text from 2 Corinthians that Elspeth read for us, we hear Paul talking about a mystical experience where he's taken up to the third heaven, caught up into paradise, where he heard things that no mortal is permitted to repeat. And he also talks about being given a thorn in his flesh, a thorn in his flesh to keep him from being too elated about these revelations. There have been many theories by theologians as to what this thorn was. Some have said it was an illness, like malaria. Others said it could have been his poor eyesight. Others said that the thorn was one of his colleagues or even his mother-in-law. There is no definitive answer, but I believe that a compelling case can be made that the thorn is a wound he carries from his past, a self-inflicted wound. He talks about the thorn as being something that keeps him from being too elated, or to use words he uses elsewhere, becoming too zealous for the faith. Paul's past inclinations for zealotry are well documented in his writings and in the book of Acts. Still, when he was known as Saul, Paul described himself as the Pharisee of Pharisees who intensely persecuted the followers of Jesus. In his epistle to the Galatians, he says, "For you have heard of my previous way of life, how intensely I persecuted the church of God and tried to destroy it." The book of Acts describes how, after witnessing the stoning of Stephen, he, quote, "approved of the killing." That day, a severe persecution began against the church in Jerusalem, and all except the apostles were scattered throughout the countryside of Judea and Samaria. But Saul was ravaging the church by entering house after house, dragging off both men and women, end quote. It was on the way to one of these raids on the road to Damascus that Saul had his well-known experience of the risen Christ. Christ. Suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice say, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Why do you persecute me?" Paul, better than anyone else, knows that there is only a short distance from elation to zealotry to persecution. Perhaps this is the thorn in the flesh that Paul speaks of. Perhaps it is the pain he has caused. Perhaps the thorn is the memories of him violently dragging people out of their homes, of trying to punish them for having beliefs that were different than his. Perhaps it was the own realization of the pain that he was able to cause. It was a thorn he carried his whole life, and one that would shape his life and his ministry. Our texts today invite us to ask, what is the thorn in our flesh? What is the pain we carry? The pain we have felt, the pain we have caused. Our texts invite us to see how this pain has shaped us, the decisions we have made, how we react when this pain is triggered afresh by a comment or a memory or a story on the news. The thorns we bear are individual and they are communal. The pain felt and caused by groups of people, whether they be families or communities like Nazareth, or nations like Canada, or the church. In Paul's vision, Christ tells him, "My grace is sufficient for you, for power is made perfect in weakness." This statement was either forgotten or not fully absorbed by the ancient church, because once it was no longer subject to official persecution and became the church of the empire, it all too quickly succumbed to the temptation to make itself powerful, to present itself as spiritually superior to the pagan religions of the world. Perhaps, like me, recounting the story of the zealous Saul pulling people out of their homes for not sharing their beliefs of the dominant religion makes you think of similar scenes described by survivors of residential schools here in Canada, of kids being scooped out of their homes, of their hair being cut, their names being changed, their language sometimes violently beaten out of them. Over 3,000 of them not coming home, with the remains only now being found decades later. And the ones that did return carrying with them the pain that still cuts deep into the flesh of their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. The pain of the residential school system is something Indigenous people have been bearing for generations. And despite having an entire volume of the Truth and Reconciliation Report dedicated to missing children and unmarked burials, it is a thorn in the flesh of this country that many non-Indigenous people are just becoming aware of now. What do we do with pain? The pain we have felt, the pain we have caused, the pain that is personal and communal, the pain that accumulates over generations. What do we do when the pain is triggered afresh by a comment or a memory or a story in the news? Do we lash out? Do we retreat? Do we build walls or topple statues? We turn back now to Paul and to Jesus to see how their pain shaped their life and their ministry. When Paul asked for the thorn in his side to be removed, Christ said, "My grace is sufficient for you, for power is made perfect in weakness." Paul writes to the church in Corinth that, "I will boast all the more gladly of my weakness, so that the power of Christ may dwell within me." This echoes what he says in Galatians, "It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith." Whatever the precise nature of the thorn in the flesh, Paul sees it as functioning to remind him that whatever power he has comes not from him, but from Christ. The thorn is an antidote to his own narcissism and propensity to zealotry and violence. It is a constant call for him to humility. It tempers the temptation to seek worldly power and instead seek the true power of God, which is always working towards healing and freedom and reconciliation. "My grace is sufficient for you, for power is made perfect in weakness." This upside-down notion of power is also present in Jesus' reaction to his rejection in Nazareth. Upon realizing that the pain he was carrying over his birth status was preventing him from healing people, it was then that he understood that his mission was not his alone. He would need help. It was after his rejection in Nazareth that he sent the disciples out on missions of their own for the first time. It was this moment when a movement was born, and not a movement of power or glory, but of vulnerability. Jesus sent the disciples out into the world and ordered them to only take what they would need: a walking staff, a tunic, and some sandals. No bread, no bag, no money in their belts, not even a second tunic. Vulnerable and completely dependent on the hospitality of those they would encounter along the way. Vulnerable and completely without means to impose their views by force or retaliate with violence if they were rejected. Just shake the dust off their sandals and keep going. It would be a hard road, this road of vulnerability and dependence. But the disciples would not need to go alone. No bread, no bag, no money in their belts, but he did send them out in pairs. Jesus sent them out in pairs. He knew that by supporting each other, his followers and the ones who would follow after them would be able to heal many more than he could ever heal himself. Jesus knew that by being in the world, we would encounter pain. The pain we feel, the pain we cause, personal pain, communal pain, and the pain that spans generations. And he knew that the path towards healing and reconciliation is one that must be walked together. And when differences of beliefs and cultures are encountered, the first step is always towards humility. As we are confronted with the thorns we carry as individuals, as citizens of this country, as disciples of Jesus, let us always be mindful that the movement he started and Paul continued and we continue now was meant to be one of vulnerability. It was meant to be one that was strong only in its weakness. It was meant to be one of utter dependency on the grace of God and on each other. Our places of pain are the places where we most fully encounter Christ. For even though he enfleshed the power of God, he too had places of pain that shaped his life and his ministry. The movement he started was never meant to be about domination. It was always meant to be about healing. My grace is sufficient for you, for power is made perfect in weakness. For then, for now, for always, may it be so.